We are so blessed to be able to draw encouragement and a boost to our faith by being with each other today, but most importantly, how good it is to come and express to God the worship that is due His name. So thank you for being here, and we certainly welcome those who are visiting with us. We appreciate your presence so very much. Paul writes to us and he says, "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ, I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain." Well, her name was Vera, Countess of Cathcart. And until 1926, she was basically an unknown member of the British aristocracy through marriage. But then she made a visit to New York City, where she was detained at Ellis Island and denied entry. Why? Well, she had come to New York to see friends and to promote her play that she had written called Ashes of Love. If you've never heard of it, you didn't miss anything. The reason why she was detained is because immigration officials had learned that several years before, she had committed adultery with the Earl of Craven and had left her husband, the Earl of Cathcart, and run off with the Earl of Craven. She got a divorce from her first Earl, but her relationship with the second Earl, the Earl of Craven, didn't last, and they broke up, and that's the play Ashes of Love. Now, Sister Elaine's not with us today. She's been sick, and I'm sure she's live streaming. And I'm sure Sister Elaine's thinking right now, "I'm glad I stuck with my first Earl, the Earl of Metcalf. Personally, my favorite Earl I've ever known." Okay. But what's going on with this woman? Well, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, the United States had implemented new immigration policies. They were trying to keep people out of America that they thought would harm American society, and they even passed a law that said anyone who had been guilty of, quote, moral turpitude could be barred from entering the United States. Now, that's not a term we use a lot, moral turpitude. So what is moral turpitude? Technically, it means a departure from ordinary standards of honest, good morals and justice or ethics as to be shocking to the moral sense of the community. The law was intended to keep out criminals and troublemakers and so forth, but it was a very broad definition, anything that the community thought was immoral. Well, somebody tipped off the officials at Ellis Island and said, "You need to watch for this lady." And when they interviewed the countess, she boldly stated that she had been involved in a relationship, an adulterous relationship with the Earl of Craven, and was divorced from the Earl of Cathcart. And so they detained her. She spent several days at Ellis Island in detention. And they finally decided that she had to be deported, sent right back to England. But she made an appeal, and she was released for a few days into New York on a $500 bond. Then she appealed again, and the officials decided to give it up because the media, both in Britain and America, had grabbed the story and made a big thing out of it and said that this was ridiculous and so forth. And so finally, the officials allowed her free entry into the United States. Here's my question. Can you imagine a famous person today having trouble entering the United States because they had been guilty of adultery and had been involved in a divorce? Of course not. People don't care about those things. Such behavior is commonplace, even for public figures, and people have no qualms with public figures being involved in such things. I want you to think about what that reflects. For several in the audience here, you know that the expression, "here's Johnny," means something. It's a reference to the most successful late night talk show in television history, The Tonight Show, hosted by Johnny Carson, which ran from the early 1960s to the early 1990s. So I want to talk to you about this signature expression, "here's Johnny," and also say, "here's Billy." The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson was the hangout for famous people. Famous musicians, movie stars, even politicians, all the big movers and shakers of the day went on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s. And that included several, at least three appearances from my research, of Billy Graham being on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Now, Billy Graham was one who oftentimes hobnobbed with famous people. And he was a master of using mass media like television. But the fact that Billy Graham, a preacher, would appear on a late night talk show and say the things that he did on this show is fascinating. I reference one particular appearance that you can actually look on it at YouTube and watch it. Not now. I'll give you the summary. It was in June of 1973. And Graham talked with Carson about the following things: his recent crusade to Korea and showing footage of hundreds of thousands of people coming to hear him preach. They talked about Bible translations. They talked about the problem of psychological issues in modern American society. They talked about life after death. They talked about moral standards of movies. And they talked about God punishing people in hell. And at several points in the interview, Graham talked about how that all of us are sinners and need to be saved through Jesus Christ. Now, Billy Graham, as a Calvinist and premillennialist, had several erroneous teachings in his work about salvation and about the end of times. But he was clear in stating in that interview that humans are lost in sin and need to be saved by Christ. And their eternal destiny hangs on that. He was plain in saying that. So why was Billy Graham on one of the most watched television programs saying those things in 1973? It was acceptable in the public. They would not bring him on, knowing what he would say. This was not his first appearance, by the way, unless there was a reason. It was palatable to the American public. It was acceptable what he was saying. What Graham was saying, actually, in the early 1970s, represented the basic values of many people living in America, even though personally they may sit in their living rooms and they may snicker at some raunchy joke on The Tonight Show. They had a belief system from their upbringing and from their culture that was in agreement with the very basic facts that there is a God, Christ is the Savior, and humans are in sin. Now here's my question. Can you imagine a preacher going on the Jimmy Fallon show and talking about sin and the need for Christ to save them? Occasionally you do see a religious leader in the public arena on some public mass media, interviewed on some show. But usually what they talk about are some social problems in America, or they talk about maybe having how you can have good mental health or have a positive life and those kinds of things. They do not speak in the mainstream media about sin, heaven, hell, and salvation in Christ. That's not talked about. So both of these examples tell us something. All the way back to 1926 and all the way up to as recently as 1973, that that was a different America. The public arena has changed. American culture has changed. Even in the lifetime of many sitting around here. Why has it changed? How has it changed? And so what? What should that mean to us? Well, we're continuing in our series of evaluating who we are as God's people living in the world today. And we've been talking about our identity as God's people. And now we're looking at this second phase, the times in which we live. We're headed toward, well, what mission do we have, being who we are, living when we're living and where we're living? What is our mission? What is our work? We're headed to that. And at the end of the lesson today, that's where we'll end up. But before we do that, this is the second lesson about the times in which we live, and we want to make it very contemporary and bring it up all the way to 2022. But we come back to this point that we made last week, and that is the importance, as God's people, of understanding the times and the culture in which we live, that which is around us. I want you to consider a sampling of three texts, the first one over in the Minor Prophets in the book of Amos. In the sixth chapter. And what Amos is doing here in these statements in Amos chapter 6 is very common regarding what Old Testament prophets did, these writing prophets toward the end of the Old Testament during the divided kingdom and the exile and the return. Amos says this about contemporary Israel and what was coming. Amos 6, beginning in verse 1. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion and to those who feel secure on the mountain of Samaria. The notable men of the first of the nations to whom the house of Israel comes, pass over to Calneh and see, and from there go to Hamath the great, then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are you better than these kingdoms? Or is their territory greater than your territory? O you who put far away the day of disaster, and bring near the seat of violence. Woe to those who lie on beds of ivory and stretch themselves out on their couches and eat lambs from their flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and like David invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. Therefore, they shall now be the first of those who go into exile, and the revelry of those who stretch themselves out shall pass away. Amos saw the sin, the corruption, the rebellion of those in Israel, especially their leaders. He comments on them living in the lap of luxury, ignoring God, and he says, "Your judgment's coming." But what I want you to see is more than just the prophecy. The prophets could know the future and lay out before those to whom they spoke regarding what God was going to do as the Spirit guided them. But before they talked about the future, they talked about the present. They described the situation that people were living in. You see, one big work of the prophets of the Old Testament is that they were interpreters of what was happening to the people right then. And then they prophesied in a lot of that about what was going to happen. But they started with the present. I want you to consider the statement by Paul in Romans chapter 1. Paul writes in Romans chapter 1 to this church in Rome about the need for salvation. And he starts with the Gentile world. And in Romans chapter 1, though Paul was a trained Jewish rabbi, note the understanding he had of the world around him. Beginning in verse 20, for his invisible attributes, speaking of God, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. Not only does Paul very accurately describe the Gentile world leading up to his time, it's also an apt description of the Gentile world during Paul's time. Paul understood that world, and he ties it to what he sees, to what God thought of it, and how that it was lacking. And this is what made Paul effective. And he writes about this over in the Corinthian letter, in the first one, in chapter 9. He's writing about his work in the preaching of the gospel and carrying the gospel to other people. And Paul worked in a lot of different environments, a lot of different settings. And this is why he's effective. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 20, he writes, "To the Jews I became as a Jew, in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but rather under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I became all things to all people, and by all means that I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings." Paul is not saying that he was some kind of chameleon, where he changed who he was regarding his essence and his faith and his morality. But what he's writing here is whether he was working with Jews or he's working with Gentiles, he understood who they were, and he related to them, and he got at their level. What does that require? Well, to be effective like Paul in interacting with different kinds of people, you've got to understand them, which means to understand their culture, understand how they think and how they live. And without compromising the gospel, you adapt how you connect to those people. Both Jesus and Paul and the preachers you read about in the book of Acts, as they took the gospel to people, they had an acute sense of those around them and an acute awareness of the environment and the circumstances those people were in. And that's why they were effective. And as God's people today, we can do nothing else. We've got to have an understanding to be effective. So we continue to evaluate American culture this morning. Last week, we looked at the roots of American culture and what brought America to the point where we are today. And today, we want to look at the contemporary American culture and understand it. So our focus this morning is going to be on the late 20th, early 21st century. In other words, our lifetimes, our generations. But I want you to consider this list. These are the things we saw from last week's study that were carried into American culture from earlier times. First of all, the heavy influence of Protestant evangelicalism. You still see the vestiges, like the little crumbs left over from that. For instance, who can sell alcohol, who can buy alcohol, and when you can get it, and where you can get it. Most places in the world, there aren't such limitations. But in America, depending on the county and the city and the state, there are significant limitations. And that is a product of prohibition from the early 20th century, which was done away with. But what was left were regulations about alcohol. And the reason why the prohibition happened to begin with, not completely, but greatly, is because of religious forces in America. That's just one little example. But America carried into the late 20th century a culture that had been heavily influenced by what we could call Protestant evangelicalism. And the idea that in America there had been this emphasis on freedom of religion, which resulted in an incredible free market of religion with innumerable options. I mean, it's like going to an ice cream store, a big one, and they've got just so many choices. They're just every kind of ice cream you can imagine. people in the 1800s and even to this day who visit America, they marvel at the many religious options that people in America have. It's not so in so many other places. It's a wide open marketplace. And early on and throughout, and I would have you see that continually it's increasing, there is an emphasis on individual rights and freedoms, and that the supreme value in America is that every individual gets to think and do and say whatever they want to. Now, we understand there's good in that. The fact that I can stand right here today and proclaim the Bible and talk about these things is in part product of the First Amendment. We said that last week, and that's a good thing. But I want you to see the big picture and how that this becomes in America the supreme value and the different ways that people can take it, good and bad. And fourth of all, we noted last week that carried into our day was the practice all through American history of holding up the banner of Christianity for national purposes and encouraging public faith, prayer and Bible reading and references to God, in that this banner was flown by both religious and political leaders, and sometimes it was not out of the motivation of helping people's souls, but for other reasons. Now, that's what was brought into the late 20th century. And then what happened at the end of the 20th century? Now, you may be thinking, is he going to talk about the 60s? And all the things of the 60s? Well, let's talk about the 60s, 70s, and 80s just really quickly. Because really, I would have you see that it's a transition period. And the data proves this out. What was characteristic of the 60s and 70s? The reality is, most people in the 60s and 70s, the American culture, most people were living in the same culture as they had been in the 1940s and 50s. What gets the sensational news, what makes the pages of the history books, and what makes it to the documentaries, are all the extreme things going on in the 60s, but most people didn't think that way and live that way. And two characteristics of the 60s would be relaxed sexual morals, in part brought on by new types of contraception, and also challenges to traditional authorities, whether it be government or school or home or religion or whatever. These are characteristics of the 60s, early 70s, sort of the Vietnam era. And this happened in America, but it probably didn't reflect the majority of people. And so that's why in the 70s and 80s, you have a little bit of a backlash in America. And you have that people in America who held to other kinds of values begin to speak out. And so something interesting happens. And a lot of people today wouldn't think this, but most Protestant evangelicals in America had not been involved in politics that much. That changed in the late 70s through the 80s. Large numbers of Protestant evangelicals, even churches and parachurch organizations, got involved in the public arena, especially in politics. And you've heard of things like the Religious Right and the Moral Majority and those kinds of organizations. Those really emerged somewhat of a backlash to the 60s and the 70s. And there's actually a little bit of a surge in traditional religion in the 1980s. But these are transition decades. It's like convulsions. Then something happens, starting around the 1990s, and the data is just incredible on this. I'm going to show you some data. American culture doesn't convulse. It doesn't like veer or lean. American culture takes a turn, and it is a definite turn, and it is a distinctive turn, and it is a lasting turn all the way to 2022. So, what's the turn? What's the difference? Well, first of all, think about how people look at life and their basic philosophy. There is a fundamental philosophical underpinning that shifts starting in the 1990s, roughly. And that is the definition of truth shifts from something that is objective. There is truth out there. And we may differ on what that truth is, and we may argue and debate it, but there is truth there, to the idea of, no, we're not really pursuing truth. We're pursuing what we think is truth. it becomes more subjective. So go on this really quick run back with me. So where did people say that truth and meaning came from? Around the time, as we saw last week, remember the map, when people started coming from Western Europe over to the Americas. Around that time, what most people would say is, well, truth comes from God. They would say that truth comes from an otherworldly source and from a divine source. Now, Catholics and Protestants fought over what that was, but they would agree that truth and meaning in life comes from a divine source. We saw last week, though, around the time of the founding of the American Republic, with the Enlightenment philosophy, that some of the leaders in Europe and in America began to say, well, you know, you can find truth and meaning by just looking at the world around you, by using your senses and using human intellect. It was called an age of reason. So humans can find truth through their own faculties and their own abilities. And it minimized reaching up to the divine source, reaching up to God. It emphasized human understanding and human ingenuity and human knowledge to find truth and meaning. And that continued to grow in American culture until you get to about the late 20th century. And what you begin to see, and it's so vividly demonstrated now, is that meaning and truth is constructed by self. Truth is what you say that it is. It means that it's subjective. And you may have heard this expression, and that is my truth, which means I have a truth and you have a truth. And some people are crediting, though probably it doesn't go all to her, but she helped to popularize this idea. It was Oprah Winfrey was giving a speech when she was given some award in 2018 at the Golden Globes Awards. And she made this statement, which got a lot of attention. She said, what I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And that has been quoted over and over the last several years. Now, if by your truth, that means your perspective on life, your opinion, we all have an opinion. We all have perspective. Some people like Toyotas, some people like Chevys. Okay? If it means your story, everybody's got a story. You've had unique experiences and things happen to you, and so you have this unique experience. But that's not how it's being used. By a lot of people, that expression, my truth or your truth, is being used regarding truth. That instead of referring to the truth that's out there, you have a truth, I have a truth, we all have different truths, and they're all true. In other words, it's like a distortion of reality. You know, we started off in the very first lesson talking about identity and the crisis that many people are having regarding even the very simple thing of determining whether they're male or female. And it's a real problem. That stems from this ideology. You know, it doesn't matter what physical reality is, because gender is a physical reality. I can make the reality what I want to make it. That has been a philosophical shift in American culture for the last several decades. Not that it wasn't there before, not that you don't see it through time in different civilizations, but there has been an acceleration of this philosophy in American culture. And then there's morality. The moral climate in America has shifted. I've got up there divorce for any reason, sexual relations before marriage, abortion and homosexuality. Those are four big ones in the last several decades, but there are others. What has happened in American culture is not that these things have been introduced for the first time. No, they've not been introduced for the first time. When the Countess of Cathcart was detained for adultery and divorce for unfaithfulness, She wasn't the only person around guilty of that. There were tons of people guilty of that. And homosexuality, and having abortions, and all kinds of other things. But here's the point. Those kinds of activities, though commonly practiced, were negatively viewed by the public. They were carried out in hiding. They were carried out with some embarrassment because everybody knew society officially frowned on those things. That's changed. Society doesn't frown on these things anymore. Not at all. What are some reasons why it's changed? I don't know. I will suggest three things. One is new ideas of psychology got traction in the 20th century that began to redefine what is normal behavior and what is abnormal behavior in people. And all through time, what is normal behavior and what is abnormal has been connected to morality. Again, and I keep beating this drum, the acceleration of individual freedoms. I have the freedom to do whatever I want to do, which means I can live any kind of moral life I want to live, and there's nothing wrong with it. That has accelerated that idea of freedom and individual rights. And there have been new legislation, both at a local level, state level, and national level, that have removed restrictions and prohibitions regarding some of this activity. Now, whether that's the dog wagging the tail or the tail wagging the dog, which came first, you know, the chicken and the egg, I don't know. But again, it contributes to society saying, oh, that's okay. It's no big deal. In other words, what used to make people blush doesn't anymore, if they blush at all. That's changed. And then there are the religious changes, which are very, very clearly seen. I would break them down into three categories. First of all, the decreased presence of religion in the public arena. Now, what am I talking about here? I'm talking about things like prayer in schools, nativity scenes on city property, monuments to the Ten Commandments at the state, you know, federal or a federal building, something like that. We've all heard of controversies and disputes about these things. These are public images and icons of the old Protestant evangelicalism that goes back in American history. Those things are being taken out of the public arena. Now, hang with me. Let's think like a New Testament Christian should think. Not what the religious world tells us to think, but like a New Testament Christian. As New Testament Christians, those things should mean very little, if anything, to us. Because as we saw last week, there is a huge difference between public and civic faith and personal faith. Public faith means nothing to God. It's fickle. Personal faith does. You can get all the school kids reciting the Lord's Prayer, and you can put up a Ten Commandments monument in front of every courthouse. That will not make people follow Jesus Christ. It doesn't work that way. And it's shallow to think that we can impose certain requirements on people or do certain public symbolic things and everybody will follow God. That is a very non-biblical way of thinking about things. It's sort of akin to the monarchs in Eastern Europe who, when Christianity began to infiltrate parts of Eastern Europe, there were monarchs that ordered everybody in their kingdom to go down to the river and be baptized. Well, what good did that do them? Most of those people didn't even know who Jesus was. It's like some Native American tribal chiefs who told their people to start practicing Roman Catholicism because the missionaries came in to Florida or southwestern America and they thought, aha, I'll get the Spanish on my side and they'll help me fight my enemies like the Apache or somebody like that. And that happened. Those things aren't true conversions. Faith is not to be group imposed. Faith is personal. It's a personal decision. But I point this out because it represents something to us. Why was it common to have nativity scenes on public property, in Bible readings in school? Which I can remember when prayer and Bible reading was in school and nobody paid attention to it, by the way. Not that impactful. What those things show us, those shifts, is that at one point, American society wanted those things. Now they don't. And what's important about it is what it reflects. What it reflects is that those things are important to American society, which tells us that American society has changed. And consider these other two shifts with the data. The number of people identifying as religious has greatly declined, oddly enough, starting in the 1990s. Here is a Gallup poll. Gallup's pretty solid. They've been doing this for decades. You can see here, this is church membership among United States adults, and it's declined. This is people saying, I belong to a church. So this would not include people who were not, quote, Christian in their identity, okay? So as you can see here, going back to the early 20th century, this stayed really close. Look at this. Very little change. A little bit of a dip. And see, even in the 60s, it didn't really change. See that? Oh, wow. What a drop there, starting around the 1990s. Here is another representation of this change. This is people saying they have a religious affiliation. That means whether they're Catholic or Lutheran or Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist or Baptist or whatever. And look how close these time slots are. 1998 to 2000, 90% of people polled in America, and these are polls, there are limitations, 90% at the very end of the 20th century said they were religious. From 2016 to 18, it dropped to 77%. That's significant. Very significant. Now, this is Gallup. I want to help you see the validity of these. This is Gallup. Add 19 and 4. I'll help you. 23. 23% of Americans were saying they don't identify with a religion. Now, this is a survey by the General Social Survey. Not as well known as Gallup, but probably more extensive and more scientific. It's out of the University of Chicago. They've been doing this for decades, and they deal with culture and politics and society and economics. They're really good. Look at this. This is accelerating growth of the unaffiliated. These are people saying, I don't have a religion. Starting 72, here's Billy Graham on Johnny Carson. Only 6% of Americans said they weren't religious. And it stays pretty solid, right? And then wham, look how it shoots up. And look at what the number here is, 2018, 23%. They got 23% too in their survey. Completely different sets of people, or you know, looking at this, organizations. By 2018, 23% of Americans, roughly one out of four, said, I have no religion. None at all. And not only is there a decline in people identifying as religious or in religious involvement, I want you to look at the generational reality of this. The older you are, you tend to be more religious. This is percentage with a religious preference. I'm Lutheran, or I'm Methodist, or I'm Hindu, or any kind of religion. Those born 45 and earlier, 89%. Those who are millennials, born after 1980 to 2000, 68%. Those who aren't affiliated with anything in this younger pool here, 29 and 18%. But the older you get, like the boomers and the traditionalists, 14 and 9%. Do you see that? With each generation, people are less religious in America. That's just the facts. That's the data. You just can't avoid those numbers. And not only are people less religious, the ones who are religious, their religion is tied up more in an individual thing, not a group thing. Before, when most people thought about religion, they thought about being part of a church or a synagogue or something like that. No, it's less and less of that. This chart back here that shows the percentages with a religious preference, the dark green people. Here's when the dark green people were asked, so you have a religion, okay? Do you have a church membership? They're religious, but among the millennials, only 57% had a church connection. And even down here in these older generations, only 66% of boomers. Only, not all of Americans, but Americans who said they were religious, 66% only of the boomers says, yeah, I belong to a church. Americans are becoming less religious. And even if they have religious notions, they're not part of a group. Huge shift. And that's why you hear a lot of talk about being spiritual but not religious. And what they mean by that is, well, I've got these ideas about God and my soul, but I'm not part of any kind of group or organization. That's not me. America's changed. Definitely America's changed. And for those who are probably, well, I say over 40, in our lifetime, okay? In our lifetime. Now, the obvious question next is, why? Why the change? Well, here's my first answer. There's no way I'm going to stand here and say, I know the reasons why. I don't. And if you've got some insight on this, I'm all ears. I want to hear it. I think we have to start with, I don't exactly know all the reasons why. And I've been thinking about this a lot and reading about it a lot. But this is a list of things that are factors in this. So here are some possible contributors to this. One is increased American diversity as far as race, nationality, and culture. Now, immigration policies changed in the late 1960s in America. Before 1960, really from about 1890 to 1960, immigration policies in America favored Europeans coming to America. But beginning in the late 1960s, a lot of those old restrictions were lifted, and more people migrated to America from Asia, from Africa, from the Middle East. Which means more people coming to America without a background connected to something about Christianity. More Muslims, more Hindus, more Buddhists in America, starting in the late 1960s. So, another chart. This is a chart about foreign-born. I want you to focus on the blue line right now. Two big surges of immigration in American history. One is back at the turn of the century. This is, you know, give me your huddled masses yearning to be free kind of era. Statue of Liberty goes up in the 1880s, you know, becomes a symbol. Ellis Island opens up around 1898 or something like that, around 1900 maybe. Huge immigrations coming. Italians and Poles and Russian Jews being persecuted. In 1910, 14.8% of Americans had been born on foreign soil. And then that dips. You see this? Of course, what's happening in here in Europe? World War I, the Great Depression, World War II. Europeans stopped coming to America in large numbers. Then in the 1960s, immigration policy changes and doors are opened up to more people coming from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. And look what happens. Now, well, 2010, and I think that number got a little bit bigger around 2012, but roughly it's the same number today, about 12.9. Not as many as back here, but we've had a second surge of immigration, and it has a North Carolina application. Those of you who are old-time North Carolina people, you know this, that when the dot-com IT thing took off, the triangle took off, and North Carolina's economy really boomed, and the population of North Carolina really increased, And Asheville is a little bit of an anomaly, okay, than that part of North Carolina. But across the board, look what happens. Foreign-born people living in North Carolina. Look at that number, how consistent it is through the 20th century, until you get around 1990. Now 7.5%, lower than the national average, but a lot bigger since then. Here's where I want you to stop again. I want you to stop and focus on thinking like a New Testament Christian. We're going to talk about our mission starting next week for two lessons. But this is where this is creeping in to our mission as God's people. People are people. Somebody moves in next door to you and they've got sort of a strange car and a strange dog. You're like, what's going on? Okay. Humans are like that. They like the familiar. They like the comfortable. And Americans generally don't like people who are different from them coming into America. Every culture's been like that. It's just that America's had so many immigrants that it's been accelerated. So here's where I want you to think, not like people typically think. I encourage you to think like a Christian should think. This is not problematic. It's an opportunity. Because this is what Christ told his people. When he commissioned the apostles, he says, go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. Christians have always had this charge to share the gospel. And as the book of Acts bears it out, with the gospel going to the eunuch, into Cornelius, into Lydia, and everybody else, you share it with anybody and everybody. As Paul would say, Jews with the law, those without the law, as many as you can to share the gospel with them. Americans have an opportunity of not going to the world and sharing the gospel, but the world coming to us. And we can share the gospel. That's how Christians should look at this. I know there are all kinds of social and political problems with immigration. I got that. And I have no interest in discussing that with anybody. I don't. And you may have opinions about that. And you may have some really good points. And I may agree with you on a lot of things. That's not really what I want to think about. What I want to think about is, okay, what does that mean to a Christian? It means an opportunity. That change in American culture, though, has created a different cultural environment. But we should see through that and see opportunities. Second of all, why has American culture changed since roughly the 1990s? Well, those of you who can remember this, remember some scandals related to religious leaders and religious organizations. I think it actually starts with Jim Jones in the late 1970s. Down in South America and the Jim Jones cult, where there was massive suicide. It was sort of like the first bomb that was dropped, and that was dramatic. But in the 1980s, America was talking about the scandals of televangelists, who at one time were very powerful and influential and wealthy, Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart being two of them. And then you begin to see the movement of, quote, the mega churches. In the 1990s, and some of those mega churches, some of those leaders and some of those organizations had both sexual scandals and financial scandals because they had a lot of money coming in, sometimes millions of dollars. And then, accelerating in the 2000s, was the scandals involving Roman Catholic priests and the sexual abuse cases, which all came to light, been going on for decades and been covered up by the Roman Catholic hierarchy. And a lot of people got a real distaste in their mouth about that. And so what you have is this cultural buildup of people getting very turned off to religion. And understandably so, because of all those scandals and abuses and misbehaviors. And then there's the ending of the Cold War in the early 1990s. Remember how we saw last week that American political leaders were very savvy in saying, we've got to stand against communism, and we all would have a long list, wouldn't we, of all the terrible things about communism, completely. But American leaders were saying, see, one of the bad things about communism is it's atheistic, and it was. Which means if you want to be a good American, you need to believe in God. And so there was a lot of cultural pressure to be religious and believe in God to oppose those atheistic communists. Well, that just went away. And so that pressure in culture, I pledge allegiance to the flag, United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God. That was put in there during the Cold War, under God. Trying to get all those school kids to connect. Be loyal to America and be loyal to God. Don't be a communist. Well, now we have to tell kids what communism was. It's not a real threat anymore. So there's that cultural momentum that's gone away because the Cold War has gone away. And then, getting this really fresh in our memories, radical terrorism that exploded, especially in the 2000s, a little bit in the 1990s, but specifically with 9/11 and that terrible event took place. And there is this broad kind of sensitivity about, and some people would say, see, that's what religious extremism does to people. Well, that's the conclusion that some people made. I don't think it's logical, but that's where some people ended up, is they got a little bit fearful of religious activity and really religiously committed people. And even people would say that, oh, there's no difference in somebody in America who's radical in their belief system that denies people that they should have abortion or it's wrong to be homosexual. There's no difference in that and the people who blew up the World Trade Center. And there is a difference, big difference. But that contributed to the societal anti-religion drift. And then once again, I'll beat it once again, greater manifestation of individualism. I can be and do and say whatever I want to, and that means anything morally, anything religiously, and it's just as right as anybody else. And then this, I think there's been growing misconceptions about what a Christian really is and what Christianity is really about and about the Bible. In an earlier time, when people had more insight about biblical teaching, I think there were less misconceptions. But think about it. With less people exposing themselves to religious teaching of any variety, what is that going to lead to? Misinformation, misconceptions, prejudices. There are a lot of prejudices toward people who claim to be Christians. Sometimes unfairly, Christians are associated with being judgmental, racism, and being ignorant when it comes to science. Well, I'm sure there are people who call themselves Christians who would be guilty of those things. But as Christians trying to be godly people and to stand for the truth of God, but to do it with love and compassion, we've got work to do about not being judgmental toward people while not compromising God's truth and morality. Is that we've got to treat all people, no matter who they are, with love and kindness, as the Bible would have us to. And that we've got to have rational conversations, even about science, with people, but not giving in to the human ideas about origins while giving up the Genesis teaching of origins. We've got some work to do as Christians to counter some of those misconceptions, but prejudices exist toward Bible-believing people in our society, which makes for a different American culture. It's a very meager attempt at explaining what's changed and why. And I think I can identify what has changed, but why it's changed, that's the best I can do with it. But we need to see it. And here's why. I want you to think about these things with me in summary. We're living in a house that's been rearranged. So, I heard this story about, you know, this teenage boy that would always come in late after curfew, and finally dad had enough. And so he always tried to sneak in the house and turn no lights on and get through the house. And so dad rearranged all the furniture in the house. So when the boy tried to come in after curfew, he stumbled and fell and made a noise, you know. And we all are like that in the houses we live in and the furniture where we know it. We can have very little or no light and sort of find our way through the house, right? You know what's happened? The furniture's been rearranged. It's a completely different environment for us as Christians. And for those who have lived a few decades, we feel that situation and we're bumping into things and we don't know quite how to maneuver, okay? But understand what has not changed. This has not declined. People's need for the gospel and the effectiveness of the gospel has not changed. That has not changed. Now, here's what has changed. In America, it's been the decline of a culture influenced by the ideas of Christianity and the presence of a public faith built upon them. That's not the world we live in. Some people can remember, and they long for that day, but that day's gone. At least for the time being. So this is one of the hinge points in this whole series right here. This one statement. This is a hinge point. This is a huge peg we're driving in the ground right here. And that is, our culture has become more challenging and uncomfortable for Christians. You see, it's a little easier, isn't it? If other people sort of think the way we do, it's easier, isn't it? If other people would agree with us on morality. But that's not the case. Our culture has shifted. And we have to embrace the reality that we have a more challenging job before us as Christians. It's not 1840. It's not even 1926. And it's certainly not 1955 anymore. You know what we need to hear? We need to hear from the Apostle Peter as the Holy Spirit guides him to write this to us. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. We need to listen to Peter when he says in the third chapter of 1 Peter, but in your hearts regard Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it's better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. We need to understand we've come full circle. We're now living in a world more like the world of the New Testament. So what do? We listen to the instruction from the New Testament. Like Philippians chapter 2. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. And what we have is a situation, is that as God's people today, we're facing responsibilities more like the prophets of the Old Testament. Not that we're inspired by the Spirit, but our responsibility in reacting to the culture around us is more like them. We are to be the light and the message and the voice of God, even though other people don't want to hear it. And even if they're not going to listen, let's really ram a steel rod up our spine. Even when they don't obey, our responsibility is to announce the message of God and to live it humbly and faithfully. That has not changed. And that's the assignment God's given us, because those are the times we live in. And this is like our bridge to the next two lessons. What do we do about all this? Well, one option is to bemoan and rail. Oh, I remember when. Oh, if only. I can't believe how the world's gotten. Did you hear about this? And we just bemoan and we rail and we just go off. And then we just sit. And we just stay agitated. That's one option. The other option is say, okay, here's what we need to do. Let's change culture. Let's use human tools and human tactics, and let's turn back the clock, and let's make things better. Let's change culture so we're more comfortable. That's one option. But here's what we're going to focus on, Lord willing, the next two Sundays. Completing our journey by living a gospel-transformed life with the hope and the confidence that we'll influence souls for Christ. That's what we're going to focus on. Because while it's important to understand culture, and thank you for going on this journey with me the last 2 weeks and being patient and attentive, it's important to understand culture. But our mission involves souls and the salvation of souls, not cultures and societies and nations. It's souls. Even one individual at a time, like the treasure of Ethiopia in his chariot or Lydia by the riverside. And it's to them people and the service we're to render to those people that our attention will now turn. Well, Zachary's got another song for us, and we appreciate his thoughtful selections. And as we sing this song together, anybody who is not a follower of Christ, you're encouraged to consider your situation. And if you become convinced that he is the Son of God, then if you'll confess that today and repent of your sins, we'll assist you in baptism where you can become a child of God and shine in a dark world. Let's all stand together and sing.